You're listening to The Reality Check, Episode 7 Squared, recorded July 23rd, 2009.
This is your reality check.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of The Reality Check, Canada's weekly skeptical podcast that examines scientific controversies and curiosities. I am your host, Jonathan Abrams, president of Auto Skeptics, and joining me tonight, as usual, are Adam Gardner.
What's crackulating, homeboys?
Xander Miller.
Yo, yo, yo.
And Darren McKee.
Good evening.
And today we have a really cool show. We're going to be discussing homeopathy. We've mentioned it before, but we've never gone in depth and explained exactly from the beginning what it is. So Adam's going to be discussing that. Then we have an interview with the skeptoc, Harriet Hall, who is a fantastic writer about all things alternative medicine. And then we have Darren, who's going to be debunking the myth.
The sexy myth.
Oh.
Oh, very sexy.
The myth that men think about sex every 7 seconds.
I've thought about sex like 13 times already on this podcast.
Awesome. Turns out it's every three
only
seconds.
Myth debunked.
It's all of our low-cut shirts.
I don't think about sex every 7 seconds.
It's actually
seconds.
Why men are not good at multitasking, because like women can do multiple tasks. They can think of multiple different things, whereas men are always thinking about sex in the background, so we can only do one other thing besides think about sex.
Except that's a myth. So Adam, you have homeopathy for us.
Yes.
What is this homeopathy thing?
Homeopathy is a form of complementary and alternative medicine, which is provably scientifically impossible. But don't take my word for it. The Society of Homeopaths has this to say on their official website, and this is a society of, you know, homeopaths in England, I believe. They say, scientifically, it cannot yet be explained precisely how it works, but new theories in quantum physics are going some way around shedding light on the process. What we do know is that a carefully selected homeopathic remedy acts as a trigger to the body's healing process. So they flat up say there's no explanation for it, and then they get into some quantum physics stuff, which is basically the blanket excuse for things that don't make sense.
I think it's great. I think I should start using a quantum physics for my excuse for everything.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you late for work again, Xander?
We're not entirely sure, but there are some theories
that involve quantum physics.
If an electron spins on one side of the Earth and on the other, they spin the same way.
I wasn't actually late. It's actually what it is actual quantum uncertainty.
I hate the misappropriation of quantum theory.
Yeah, it's just a catch-all by like all pseudoscience to explain things that don't really make any sense. So homeopathy was made up, and I use those words honestly, completely fabricated, by a German physician, Samuel Hahnemann. Basically, the philosophy is like cures like, which is pretty stupid.
Well, he did this when?
It rhymes, though.
150 years ago.
It was a long time ago. I don't have a year right
now.
Well,
I think it's a bit of a step up from leeches.
Yeah.
And they still use leeches.
So basically, if you have insomnia, you would use coffee to cure your insomnia.
Because like cures like.
Right? Yeah. And they literally use poisons to cure diseases which have symptoms similar to those shown by poison. So very popular homeopathic ingredient is nightshade, Atropa belladonna, which is, you know, a poison, a natural poison that just kill people in not too insane quantities.
Do you know what the symptoms for nightshade are?
You can get like tired with a low dosage, but it'll kill you.
Or another good example is that poison ivy will be used to help with rashes.
Yeah, completely silly. Basically,
onions for teary eyes.
Is it that silly though? When you have vaccines that, you know, you get injected with the virus and that protects you from the virus.
But you don't inject a vaccine once you have the disease. You inject it to protect you from the disease. Homeopathic remedies are not meant to be preventative; they're meant to cure.
Another problem.
Another
problem with the homeopathic treatments is they're targeted just for the symptom. So you use a substance that causes the same symptom.
Or
there's no connection with the cause, which is funny. Because all the alternative medicine supporters claim that mainstream scientific medicine only cares about the symptoms and not the underlying causes. But homeopathy cares about the underlying causes when the whole point behind homeopathy is like cures like. Like what? Like the symptoms. It's all about the symptoms, not about the actual true causes. So like the first principle, while it's kind of ridiculous, it's not enough to completely dismiss it, right? What's the next major principle?
Well, basically, they dilute the ingredient to the point of being negligible or pretty much a non-existent amount in the product. And this process is called patentization. So first they dilute the ingredient in water or alcohol, and then they shake it in a specific way, like back and forth and side to side. If it doesn't dissolve in water or alcohol, and it's a solid, then they can dilute it in solid lactose. The amount remaining is inert, because if it wasn't, it would actually cause the symptoms that they're trying to stop. I mean, if you actually didn't have an inert amount of coffee when you're trying to cure insomnia, it would actually, you know,
keep you up,
stimulate. Yeah. So what they use is a scale called the C scale, so or CH or whatever. Basically, for each C you have, it's a 100 times dilution. So 1 C, you have 1/100th of the original ingredient. 2 C is 1 in 10,000. 4 C, which is 10^-8, is how much arsenic is allowed in U.S. drinking water, and that's kind of a pretty low C level for most homeopathy.
Like one part per so the second major principle of homeopathy is that the more you dilute it, the stronger the homeopathic treatment gets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is counter so they gauge their strength, we know.
But they don't even really use any real science to determine what that dose is. It's not like they do it, they tried it on someone, oh, and then he passed out and he died, so maybe we'll tone it down a little. And
so food is healthy because it has an extremely diluted ratchet? Is that sort of the thing we're talking about?
Apparently, also, you can increase the strength of the homeopathic treatment by what's the term? Successing it, which is basically banging it against a leather glove.
Yeah. He used leather.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it was because of the motion you had to do. It had to have like an elastic motion, so he's using like saddles or something like that originally, but now they probably have these fancy machines to do it.
So it's not like the size, but the motion? Is that how homeopathy works?
Well, yeah, basically, you could easily strengthen a homeopathic remedy using this. So you could take something that'll make someone a little dozy or help them sleep, and you could easily turn that into a poison, and then you could make it, you know, thousands and thousands of times more powerful, and then kill an entire nation by dropping in their water supplies, if there was any logic to this. And just to show just how diluted it can get, there's a unit called the mole. Basically, a mole is the amount of a substance with the number of molecules equal to the number of carbon atoms needed to have 12 grams of carbon. So the weight of a mole of something will vary with the weight of the chemical. So elements will have their weight in grams equal to their atomic number.
Just to interrupt for a second, I always found the mole concept tricky. It's sort of like a dozen. It's a unit of an amount. So you could have a dozen bagels, and you could have a dozen something else. They might have different weights, but it's still a dozen.
It's like a dozen atoms, but it's like 10^6.8.
Yeah, so it's the number of molecules is the Avogadro constant, which is 6 × 10^23.
Which is like a trillion trillion.
Oh yeah, it's a huge ridiculous number, mm-hmm. because atoms are really small. Not this one. Atoms with a T. So at 12 C, which mm-hmm. is 10^-24, high school chemistry tells us that one mole of a substance is 60% likely to contain one molecule of a substance. Basically, 12 C is equivalent to a pinch of salt in the Atlantic Ocean. And the amount advocated by Samuel Hansen is 30 C, 10^-60, which is just like astronomically less. Basically, 2 billion doses per second given to every person on Earth for 4 billion years would cause one molecule to be taken at 30 C.
Yeah, but you don't need the molecule in the substance to have an effect, right?
Well, no. Basically, according to the homeopaths, how homeopathy works is water memory.
But they don't know how it works.
Well, how they claim it works is water memory.
But they claim they don't know how it works. It's all quantum physics.
Depends on the homeopath. Some of them have a very...
They don't claim to understand the mechanism. They can't claim to understand vaguely, you know, crap that doesn't make sense, which is water memory or molecular memory, which is why they say it's less of an effect.
I'm just trying to highlight that they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Well, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because basically there's no viable mechanism for this. It doesn't really make sense. The idea is that when molecules are in contact with other substances and then they are removed from contact with them, they will somehow retain a property with it.
So the water remembers.
Well, I could sort of see that. Like, maybe if water could retain a shape and it was the same sort of toxic, the same sort of toxins have the same things that cause the same symptoms have the same sort of shapes. If water has, like, been molded to have that shape in it.
But water has then such it could standard sort of grab, shape.
If like, you don't toxins from it, your body. Yeah, you know,
if you don't understand chemistry, that might yeah. make sense. But that's not how.
But you start works. Like
if you don't understand things, it makes sense.
Like the water, like the water that we drink was like water that dinosaurs were swimming in, and water that was like produced. In the middle of a sun somewhere, it's just well, like I mean, it,
pass through
if
the bladder.
It had memory, the things it's Oliver touched Cromwell. Are ridiculous, right?
Yeah,
that's more likely than the sunlight.
So it really doesn't make any sense. But basically, it's being used to explain the effectiveness of homeopathy, but there isn't actually any evidence that homeopathy has an effect. So right, when you actually submit it to proper double-blinded studies,
so ineffective. What you hinted at there is called Ray Hyman's categorical imperative. Which is that you shouldn't try to explain a phenomenon until you've proven that this phenomenon even exists.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we actually have an interview with Ray Hyman coming up in a later episode.
But molecular shape is very important in chemistry. Just like and how enzymes.
Well, how work. The molecule is shaped makes sense, but the H2O molecule can only
they
be shaped one way.
They don't actually retain shapes. That's the whole point.
Right.
They don't. There's no water memory where it's actually getting
right.
the shape.
The shapes are important, but there's no memory.
It's like
there's no concept of like homeopathic stuff being on the shelf too long
well,
and used, losing its shape.
Okay, if water could retain shapes, if liquids could retain shapes, then there would be this sort of there could be some sort of a explanation for an effect that hasn't been proven.
Like an ice cube.
But it's not just water, too. You can buy most of the homeopathic remedies that you can buy are actually sugar pills, mm-hmm. where they take sugar pills and they just put a drop of the homeopathic water
yeah.
on top of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they cut it with.
And so it's just going to evaporate, anyways.
Yeah.
So big deal.
Yeah.
It's basically just magic, right?
Yeah, it's like
magic spells.
Holy water or magic potion. Well, magic potions are always Eye of Newton, cool stuff like that. It's not just water shaking yeah. around. There are studies that can show that homeopathy is effective, but they are consistent with the placebo effect. Most of them show that they have a poor methodology, and when you tighten the controls, the results become statistically insignificant. Similar studies can be found to support all forms of alternative medicines, and it's a great way to show how, you know, one single study can't be trusted. You need better research than that. Rigorous independent studies should be done to prove any effect. And there simply is no effect for homeopathy. Now, a common claim that people also make is that homeopathy is safe. Well, yeah, of course it is, because it doesn't have an active ingredient. We're talking about water or sugar pills or diluted lactose or whatever. Real drugs have side effects. Nothing has no side effects. So if there's a real benefit, there's often a real risk. But if there's none, the only risk is to your wallet. And that you ignore real medicine. Which can be a major problem.
Except with this exception, which is that some products on store shelves say they are homeopathic, and they're technically correct, and they have a dilution of a substance that is in the pharmacopoeia homeopathica, whatever it's called, but they don't dilute it enough.
Yeah, if you have like 1C.
Right.
That's actually a lot.
So Zicam, trademarked, is a product that is marked as homeopathic, and when a friend of mine showed it to me, he's like, oh, I just got Zicam. I said, oh, it says homeopathic. There's nothing in it. But it turns out, they fooled me. It actually does have something in it. It has zinc in it to a real level. But because they're technically homeopathic, they got automatically approved by FDA and Health Canada. But it turns out it has a real effect. And recently, the Zicam nasal spray was taken off shelves because it turned out it was causing some people to lose their sense of smell.
Yeah. Colbert Report did a great coverage of that. He's like, who would have thought injecting a metal into your brain would have an effect on your sense of smell?
But yeah, we have an article about that on autoskeptics.org. But so you have to be careful with homeopathy. You don't just grab a homeopathic treatment off the shelf, you know, for like...
Don't grab any homeopathic.
Yeah, go to your homeopath. No, but just don't take any of it. But
oftentimes skeptics will take some kind of homeopathic treatment in front of a bunch of people, say, see, there's nothing in it, and they'll consume a dozen pills or whatever.
I was thinking of doing that for this episode, but I...
But you have to be worried about contaminants as well,
yeah.
And you have to be very careful. What it says is in there might not be true.
Or sometimes they just throw in an active ingredient. It's like, we have this homeopathic diluted this much CH, oh, and we threw in caffeine.
And
or we threw in whatever. Yeah. So that's obvious.
So people sometimes just use homeopathy
dangerous.
as a marketing play. But
yeah,
it's not
yeah,
true homeopathy.
Or I like say it's the best of both worlds. It has scientific medicine and homeopathy.
Right.
Basically, homeopathy is super popular. It seems very reputable, and it's a highly profitable business. It's available at drugstores, major grocery stores and all kinds of stuff like that.
The UK has homeopathic hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, we should
paid link for to, by the public.
We should link to that education hospital video.
I send you that video.
Public health system.
Yeah. Yeah, so check our show notes for a fantastic
video
skit by Morgan and Webb out of the UK about a homeopathic hospital.
Yeah, the concept of homeopathy opens it up to tons of
ridicule.
Tons of ridiculous jokes, which is with its ridiculous dilution stuff.
My favorite is like if you go to those homeopathic hospitals, just to see them playing doctors. Some of them are actual doctors, but just see people in like white lab coats,
yeah,
like measuring up their doses of garlic and then
and got their quote unquote degrees from correspondence courses.
What's diluted garlic do? It cures bad breath.
Yeah, something like that.
Stops diluted vampires.
That doesn't exist. Self-created.
Well, thanks, Adam, for the very enlightening and non-dilute examination of homeopathy. And another person who's written a lot about homeopathy is Harriet Hall, the Skeptoc. She is a doctor that writes a regular column for Skeptic magazine as well as for the Science-Based Medicine blog, but we discuss all this in the interview, which I will play right now.
And now for an interview with Dr. Harriet Hall, a.k.a. the Skeptoc.
So, Harriet Hall, welcome to The Reality Check. You, of course, are a writer, and you blog on sciencebasedmedicine.com, and you have a regular article that appears in Skeptic magazine. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What drew you to alternative medicine?
Well, it's complicated. I've always been a passive skeptic. I've been reading the magazines and reading books and going to conferences for years. But then I went to one of the Skeptics Toolbox workshops in Oregon one summer and got to meet Wally Sampson, who was the editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. And then one day I got an ad in the mail for vitamin O. And I thought, what? They didn't tell us there were that many vitamins in medical school. But it turns out they were selling these little drops that supposedly contained concentrated oxygen that did all kinds of wonderful things for you. And they said it was backed up by research. And I said, come on. But I sent in for their research, and I read it, and it was the worst excuse of a scientific study I had ever seen. I couldn't believe how bad it was. So I emailed Wally Sampson, and I said, can you believe this? And he said, you know, nobody really takes those things seriously. Why don't you pick it apart, critique it, and we'll publish it in the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. And I said, who, me? I can't write. I've never written anything in my life. But he encouraged me to try. And that's really how I got started.
So what, in your opinion, is the most dangerous alternative medicine treatment that's out there that you've encountered?
I would probably have to say chiropractic neck manipulations, because they can cause strokes and they can kill people. But actually, all forms of alternative medicine are dangerous because they steer people away from legitimate medical treatments and they get them thinking uncritically, which can lead to other problems in life.
Yeah, they can cause missed opportunities, right? With the chiropractic neck treatment, I heard a common rebuttal from the chiropractors is that, well, there can be some downsides. You know, there can be some risk to it, but, you know, mainstream medicine, there's thousands of people die every year from drug interactions and side effects. So what's wrong with that?
Well, that's a very unfair comparison, because you can't look at risks alone. You have to look at risks versus benefits. And no one can deny that conventional medicine saves lives and helps a lot of people. And with chiropractic neck manipulation, there is no evidence that neck manipulations are good for anything. There was a Cochrane review, and they came to the conclusion that manipulation was no better than gentle mobilization, and that neither of them worked by themselves. You had to add exercise and other modalities to them. So you're looking at something that really has no benefit, and strokes are a very rare complication. We really don't have good numbers on how rare they are, but if they ever happen, they're devastating. And to risk a rare but devastating complication for no benefit just doesn't make sense to me.
Where we're from, Ottawa, Canada, it seems like there's a chiropractic office on every single street corner. Just in my neighborhood alone, there's like a chiropractor for every 10 houses practically. Is chiropractic that popular in where you're from?
Yes, it's on every corner in my area too.
So how do you react to this when you're driving down the street and you see them like?
Well, I used to go, but my husband made me stop.
My wife made me stop doing that too. So which article that you've written, either for the Skeptic magazine or your Science-Based Medicine blog, has gotten the greatest backlash, that you've gotten the most hate mail?
Probably the one I wrote on circumcision, because I tried to just divorce myself from all the ethical considerations and just say, what is the scientific evidence that circumcision benefits or harms people? And I tried to present it very objectively, but the criticism I got was, if you aren't definitely against circumcision, that means you're in favor of it and you're mutilating little boys.
A lot of people see this issue as black and white, right?
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that article, by the way, and I've sent it to a lot of people, because myself, growing up Jewish, I have a lot of pressure from family and whatnot to circumcise, and I too want to find out what is the true scientific evidence behind circumcision. And it seems like there's just two camps out there. There's either the camp that is very pro-circumcision or very anti-circumcision, and it's hard to get at the truth. So it was very nice to have an article like that that cuts through it.
Yeah, I think there are medical benefits, but they're very small, and the question is whether that small benefit justifies doing an elective procedure on a baby that doesn't have any say in the matter.
Right, so there's the risk, there's the benefit, and then there's the extra ethical problem of a patient that is unable to make a decision for themselves.
Exactly.
In what areas do you disagree with your fellow science-based medicine bloggers, guys like Stephen Novella, Dave Gorski, Kimball Atwood?
Well, being human beings, we're bound to disagree on some things in the realm of like politics and opinions. But as far as the science, we pretty much agree with each other right down the line, because we're looking at the scientific evidence with the same standards. And the facts are the facts, and we look at them, and we come to the same conclusions, and we agree.
Do you guys ever disagree on anything in medicine? Like, are you united on medicine, but you might disagree on politics, or...?
Well, there are things in medicine that are still a little bit iffy. There's been some disagreement on the blog about the placebo effect, for instance.
Mark Crislip is big on the idea that there is no placebo effect.
Yeah.
There's nothing physiological going on. It's all statistical craziness, right? What's your opinion on the placebo effect?
Well, I've changed my mind on that. I'm not calling it the placebo effect anymore. I'm calling it the placebo response, because placebos don't cause any objective effect. But patients respond to taking a placebo in various ways.
It seems like the placebo is the core issue at stake with alternative medicine. It seems, correct me if I'm wrong, is the placebo the reason why alternative medicine is so popular and so many people fall for it?
Well, there's so many things involved. For one thing, just the natural course of disease. Things get better on their own if you don't do anything. So whatever alternative method you're using, when the patients get better, you can say, see, that method cured you, when it really didn't. I have a story I like to tell. A friend of mine had been having back pain and had been, was really getting desperate, so he decided he'd make an appointment with a chiropractor. He called on a Friday to make an appointment for Monday, and over the weekend, his pain disappeared.
Hmm.
Now, if he'd seen the chiropractor on Friday, he would have naturally assumed that the chiropractor had cured him, and he would have believed in chiropractic. So he describes that as his narrow escape.
Do you see any value in having what I would call placebo specialists, like naturopaths or homeopaths? Do you think that maybe they could reduce the workload of medical doctors who are known to have very heavy workloads?
Gee, that would be a nice cop-out, but most of us are honest.
But when I mean reduce the workload, I mean by tending to, say, hypochondriacs, people who don't need medicine, but they just need reassurance or need to think that they are getting medicine.
Well, I couldn't refer someone to a placebo therapist, because I'd either have to say, I'm sending you to a placebo therapist, which the patient probably wouldn't appreciate, or I'd have to misrepresent the truth and say, I think this person has something that legitimately can help you. So,
how do you convince a family member or a close friend to not use unscientific medicine, alternative medicine? Do you have any personal anecdotes of a success or a failure?
That is a very, very hard thing to do, and I think it depends on the family member. If they have, say, looked something up on the internet and found some facts that's made them believe something, if I can show them other facts, I might be able to convince them that the part that they read was wrong. But if they've developed a belief, just an irrational belief, and they're attached to it, there's not a thing I can do. all I can do is say, I don't agree with you because, but you have to let your family members have the independence to do whatever they choose to do. You can't make somebody stop.
Yeah, you don't want to jeopardize your relationship with them.
Right. You have to be careful how you handle it.
When you have a friend or a family member who's into this area, into alternative medicine, does it affect your perception of them at all?
I really haven't had any family members like that I could relate that to. But no, I don't think it changes my perception. I have very good friends who believe in a lot of alternative things, and I respect them. But I think they have a gap in their knowledge, or they have some kind of a little personal quirk that's made them believe something that doesn't make sense to me, but I still respect them for everything else.
If you could change one thing about mainstream scientific medicine, what would it be? Because you get criticisms all the time from the alternative medicine crowd. So do they have any valid criticisms?
Yes, they do. And I think if I had to choose one thing, it would be to reduce the fragmentation of medical care. As patients go from one specialist to another, and sometimes they don't talk to each other, and the patient gets lost in the shuffle. That's why I went into family medicine, because I think a family doctor can act as a traffic director for referrals and can get to know the patient, know the family on a personal basis, and can ensure that they get better medical care that
way. So in other words, you want scientific medicine to be more holistic, perhaps?
Scientific medicine has always been holistic, but sometimes we do a better job than others.
Before you kind of became more of a skeptic, what was sort of the most unskeptical thing that you believed in? And does that help you maybe understand people with beliefs that you don't agree with?
Oh, sure. I used to believe all kinds of things. I used to think people might have psychic powers. I remember reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull, where he was making clouds move, and I remember trying it myself, and it didn't work. But as I read some of the explanations for some of these things, I found it very satisfying to admit that I was wrong, because it meant I had learned something and I was better for it.
People have this fear of admitting they're wrong, but people really appreciate it, I think, when people do come forward and say, you know, I was wrong and I can learn from my mistakes and stuff like that. People don't value that. People don't value that attitude a lot.
Has your work proven any recent successes? Have you seen any positive outcomes from your outreach?
Yes, I've been very gratified that I wrote a couple of things on Dr. Amen and his SPECT scans and the way he runs his clinics. And now when you Google for either his name or for the name of his clinics, my critique comes up next on Google, so people can find it and find out that there's another side.
Wow, that's great.
And I've had people tell me that they have showed some of my articles to people and gotten them to change their mind.
So you think there's a lot of opportunity facing us as supporters of science-based medicine?
I hope so, and I've been very encouraged by the science-based medicine blog, because we've got some really good articles about a lot of different subjects. And now when someone emails me and asks me a question, instead of having to explain from scratch, I just say, go to this place on the blog, the answer's there.
Yeah, you're not the only one that gets to do that too. But it's really a handy resource. What areas do you think the science-based medicine movement is doing wrong and they could do a better job at?
Well, I wouldn't say we're doing anything wrong, but there are some things that we could be doing more right. And I wish there was some way we could spark the public imagination and make things more popular. All the people like Jenny McCarthy, they're so media savvy, and they've got money behind them, and they get the message out there, and we don't have anything like that.
Well, we have Amanda Peet, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive that she came out. We are a Canadian podcast, and so I have to ask, have you ever been to Canada?
Yes, I have.
And do you perceive the Canadian alternative medicine situation as being any different from the American?
I'm no expert. I haven't spent much time in Canada, but from what I've heard, I think it's very similar.
Yeah, it seems like some areas seem to be more into some type of alternative medicine than others. So where is it that you work out of, where you live?
I live near Seattle in a little town called Puyallup.
And what's the big thing there? Is it homeopathy or chiropractic or?
Probably chiropractic. There seem to be more chiropractors than anything else, but there's acupuncturists, and naturopaths are big in my part of the country because we have the premier school of naturopathy. Bastyr University is based in our area.
Have you ever considered maybe going to get a naturopathy degree so that you could be considered an expert on alternative medicine and could get on all these government panels and boards?
That has never tempted me in the slightest.
So what is it about chiropractic that makes it so popular?
Well, if you go to a doctor with a back pain, he's likely to say, I have no idea what's causing your pain, but it'll go away in a while. Here's some pills you can try. You go to the chiropractor, and he says, I know exactly what's wrong with you. I'm going to fix it, and I'm going to have you keep coming back for maintenance treatment so it won't ever happen to you again. I want to get to know you. I want to meet your whole family. And he touches you. He does these hands-on manipulations. And some chiropractors are very charismatic. They're good psychologists.
So it seems like the chiropractors are filling a gap where science-based medicine doesn't have the tools yet to properly treat someone. So that's when the alternative medicine can come into play.
Yeah, a lot of the temptation for alternative medicine is for the worried well, who really don't have anything wrong with them, but they have little normal symptoms that they're worried about. Or the people that scientific medicine can't cure. I mean, we treat diabetes, but we can't cure it. And there's so many things that we don't really understand very well yet. Science is a work in progress. So people that are dissatisfied, they hear an alternative practitioner saying, oh, I can cure your diabetes, and then you won't ever have to take insulin again. And you know, that's very seductive.
It should make people skeptical if someone's claiming they can cure everything, right? It should be a sign that scientific medicine is willing to admit we can cure some things, but we can't cure other things, and here's why.
Yeah. In one of my articles on the blog, I listed all of the things that I'd found that were the one cause of all disease on various different alternative sites, and it's an impressive list.
Yeah, it's amazing how the promoters of the different alternative medicine will work together. So you have the acupuncturists training the chiropractors who are training the acupuncturists, who are both appealing to their local politicians to get favorable laws passed, yet their practices are contradictory to each other, are they not?
Yes, and somewhere I was reading about a panel where they had people from all these different areas, and they would never criticize each other. They'd criticize conventional medicine, but they'd give each other a pass, like, you know, whatever works for you.
That just drives me nuts. Sorry, I just had to say that. Thank you so much, Harriet Hall, for giving us the time to interview you today at the amazing meeting.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed it.
And I'd like to remind all of our listeners to definitely check out the Science-Based Medicine blog at sciencebasedmedicine.com. Is that right?
.org, I think.
It's one of the two. Just Google it. and of course, check out Skeptic Magazine, and you have great articles that are published there as well. And oftentimes, we'll be featured on eSkeptic at skeptic.com.
Yes.
So have fun at the rest of the conference, and we'll see you around.
Thank you.
So thanks to Harriet Hall for letting us interview her at the amazing meeting. And so here is Darren with a segment about the myth that men think about sex every 7 seconds.
Do they? Do men think about sex every 7 seconds?
Oh, never mind.
Oh, that's mine.
Oh, it's me.
I'll just wait till you guys finish, and there you go. And the answer is no. There's just no good support or evidence or any reason to believe this.
I don't see how I could be thinking about sex every 7 seconds when I have to think about video games.
There you go. I
wouldn't be able to walk down the hall if I thought about sex every 7 seconds.
Maybe some people got this idea from a Kinsey report, and that doesn't make sense either. There's really just no good reason of why this exists. It's unreliable. If you think about how would you study this, how would you test it? And it's supposed to be on average. So, you know, if you're engaged in a task which is related to sexual activity for 5 minutes, are you supposed to average that time over your whole day? I think it just comes to the fact that people have a general belief that men think about sex more than women. It's on their mind more. And as a consequence, why not every 7 seconds compared to anything else?
But at least 10 minutes for me.
And sure. The metric doesn't even make sense. You could somehow argue men think about sex for a certain percentage of time each day. But when you say they think about it every second seconds, you don't establish a length of time for which they think about
it. Yeah, it sounds like we have like processor cycles and everything. Like, we are literally computers, and we're going every seven instruction codes, there's one thrown in there for sex.
Right, and what is a thought, and how long does a thought take, and all that. Yeah. I mean, it's just, the more you think about it, the more this makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So
the more I think about it, the more I think of sex.
Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't make any sense.
How many processor sleep cycles before there comes a sex cycle?
I think about sex for 7 seconds every 7 seconds.
Only when I'm around you guys.
You have a problem.
Thanks everybody for tuning into another episode of The Reality Check, and we'll catch you all next week.
Think better.
Later.
Ta-da.
Think better.
Think good.
Think different.
No, the difference is not good.
Think daring.
Better.
Think
faster. The Reality Check is produced by the Ottawa
Center. Download faster.
Music is provided by Pat Roach. For show notes or to discuss this episode, visit our website at ottawaskeptics.org/The Reality Check or send your email to realitycheck@ottawaskeptics.org.